Dana Carvey. One night that was a breakthrough for me is, I'd done enough of the show that the audience knew me, and I'd done enough George Bush cold openings that I was comfortable. And I remember right before I went to air, I just said to myself, the cue cards are suggestions, because Lorne doesn't like ad-libbing. I thought I'd be in trouble when I went off the script, but that didn't happen. Lorne always likes it when the room is full of laughter. David Spade. One of the bummers was we did a primetime presidential special, an election special, and it was a debate among Bush, Perot, and Clinton. So they said, you're going to play Perot. I wasn't on the show a lot. It was kind of exciting. Phil was going to play Clinton, and Dana was going to do Bush. I thought, it'll be perfect. I'll do a funny accent. It'll be a lot of fun. So we did the special, and we filmed the debate ahead of time. I got in the Perot makeup. Dana got into his Bush. Phil got into Clinton. We did the wide shot, and we all walked in. Clinton did his speaking first, then Bush did his. When it got time for Perot, they have me step out, they have Dana redo his makeup as Perot, and then he comes back in and does the close-up. It was humiliating. It was me just walking out, and it was Dana doing the fun stuff. So I was basically an extra after 45 minutes of makeup. It was just that Dana is really good, and they want a cast member doing that, and I thought they were over a barrel because he couldn't do both. It was a special with all three of them, and they would all be in the same shot sometimes. So I was going to win. And I didn't. And I was like, are they finding new ways to humiliate me? Michaels always looked for SNL characters to be spun off into movies that he would produce, and that would be box office blockbusters. He'd seen how the Blues Brothers movie struck it rich, and longed to make a movie that hit as big. The right character never seemed to come along. But that would finally change with Wayne's World, co-starring Mike Myers as Wayne and Dana Carvey as his friend Garth, two cute goofs who ran a no-budget cable-access show in Aurora, Illinois. A gigantically successful movie, followed by a gigantically anticlimactic sequel, it would be the only film derived from an SNL sketch to gross over $100 million. It was Michaels' biggest coup as a movie producer. Myers would go on to make many other films, most successfully the Austin Powers 60s spy spoofs, which contain a wicked but apparently friendly homage. The character of Dr. Evil, one of several played by Myers, has the unmistakable speech patterns and mannerisms of Lorne Michaels, although, for the record, Carvey does a better Michaels impression. Myers did not suffer from an inferiority complex. Brandon Tartikoff loved to tell the story of the time when, having moved on from NBC to the presidency of Paramount Pictures, he was trying to convince Myers, in the wake of the Wayne's World success, to agree to make a sequel. To sweeten the pot, Tartikoff asked Myers who he'd always wanted to work with. "I have a big Rolodex," Brandon said. "Give me the name, and whoever it is, they're only a phone call away." Myers thought for a moment and then said, "Fellini." Tartikoff didn't believe his ears. "Who?" "Federico Fellini," Myers replied. "I've always considered him a great artist." He looked at a flabbergasted Tartikoff, waiting for his response, or maybe expecting him to pick up the phone and dial Italy. "That's when I realized," Tartikoff said, "that he was completely serious. He really thought he was in that league now." Dana Carvey. Lorne said Mike needed a sidekick for the Wayne's World sketches. Basically, I just showed up at read-through, and there was this sketch, and I was just in there. I don't think Mike resented it. It's so infamous that it's hard to talk around this. But obviously the show was fine, and then once we got into feature film territory, defining the roles was a little harder. That's as delicately as I can put it. When it was just a sketch, I would just be reactive and laugh really hard and support him. I remember I always thought, aren't we just doing Bill and Ted? I thought we'd be nailed as doing a Bill and Ted ripoff. But I think Mike's a clever writer, and he put his own stamp on excellent and way, no way. Bill and Ted did precede us, but I guess it didn't matter. Terry Turner, writer. Mike was interested in us writing Wayne's World with him because we'd done some of the sketches with him and the collaboration seemed to work. And then Lorne came to us one day and asked us if we would like to write the movie with Mike. And we said, sure, absolutely, we definitely would love it, because it was an opportunity, so we took it. Oddly enough, Lorne's advice on the movie was don't make anyone angry at each other, because it will remind the audience too much of home, and we want them to have a good time in the theater. In a way, his light touch worked, because he only said about two or three things about the movie. And sometimes he made us a little crazy, because he didn't keep up with the dailies as much as he should have, and we had to go back and then reshoot things which could have been done sooner. But I can't complain about it, because it certainly was a great opportunity for us. I'm sure I'm not speaking out of school here when everyone knows that there was a problem with Mike and Dana on the set. I'm pretty sure everybody knows that. So there was some hostility and then some friendly hostility, and then people would band together and it spilled over into the show. I remember once Lovitz said to Dana, he was just absolutely killing in a sketch, but when Dana came off the stage, Lovitz said to him, Dana, Dana, you're coming off gay, just to undermine every bit of confidence he had. Just like, you know, a jerk. They'd pick at each other, but everybody knew it was kind of a joke, and yet sometimes it wasn't so jokey. David Spade. I think the breakthrough for me was probably when I did that sketch as the receptionist saying, and you are? And that kind of thing, which kind of worked. It was a little dry attitude, and it caught on fast, which was nice. That didn't really solidify me there, but the following year I did my first Hollywood Minute, and that's the one Lorne liked. I was just basically sitting at the table in the writer's room, bored, reading People magazine, commenting out loud about what was going on in the world and just making fun of everyone. Someone was like, why don't you just do that on the show? That's what you're good at. And that was Lauren's opinion, too. He said, you've finally found a unique voice. Just do that. And then about 2 weeks later, he said, why don't you write up another Hollywood Minute? And he had never asked me to do something like that, which basically meant it would probably be on the show. And I thought, great! So I was such a whore doing that. I probably wouldn't have done it as much as I did, but it was actually getting in the back of my head that I might get fired at that point, because it was 3 years in and I hadn't made much of a dent. And I did it every couple of weeks. It was crazy. I didn't care who I took out. I was just an unknown guy making fun of million-dollar celebrities for no reason, just to take their legs out. A year or two later, it was less interesting, because I had turned into one of them. Fred Wolfe. I would actually beg Spade to not hit the people that probably couldn't take a hit. It just drove me crazy to make fun of some of the celebrities that were already having their own troubles. I used to tell him, who knows where you'll be one day when you're turning on the TV and you'll see somebody say something as nasty about you as what you're saying about them, and it's going to just send you into a free fall. And you know, he listened to me somewhat. If you hit Madonna, she'll take it. If you hit Michael Jackson, he'll take it. But you can't hit the real easy targets. Al Franken. I originally wrote Stuart Smalley for Mike Myers. But when he did it in read-through, it didn't work because it was so specifically in my head and in my ear. And I think Smigel said I should do it, and I did it, and it worked. I felt while I was doing it that I had such good reactions that I did another one. And then, in the room between dress and air, I would, of course, demand that they cut other people's sketches so Stuart could be in the show. One day, when I was picking up tickets for the producers, the guy I got the tickets from asked me, when are you going to do a Stuart sequel? And I said, well, the movie lost about $15 million, and I've discovered that when you lose money for a studio, they don't want to make a sequel. Now, if that doesn't tell you what this business is about, I don't know what does. This is my standard answer. David Spade. I thought Bye-Bye was good, and the thing about it was that we only did it twice, and yet I still hear it. I used to think that you had to do something 25 times and beat it into their heads to get some catchphrase going, but Bye-Bye and the receptionists and you are were just kind of stumbled into. we probably should have just left it at one. Although it's never been the case, in any sketch that's worked in history, to leave it at one. It's usually, leave it at 30. Adam Sandler. Before I was on the show, I didn't really know what I was doing quite yet. But once I was in a room with, like, Jim Downey, who if you wrote a skit and Jim liked it, you were high for a week, and Robert Smigel, the same thing, it was always about impressing those guys. If you had just one line in the skit that they would comment on, you felt like you were doing something special. It was just sitting in a room with the guys you idolized. And I guess after a little while, you developed what you think was the kind of comedy you wanted to do, and the kind that those guys would disapprove of. Bob Odenkirk. I think Sandler really seemed to take everybody by surprise. I mean, the things that Adam was doing were so sort of inconsequential. Silly songs and just like basically dicking around, you know? I'd been there for a couple of years, and I really believe in good sketch comedy and great sketches, really solid sketches. And yet I thought that Sandler brought a really great breath of fresh air to the show and relaxed the show when it was getting kind of uptight and formulaic. So I liked what Adam did, but I think his fame or his success did surprise maybe everybody. Adam Sandler. I remember in the beginning when I would be on camera, Lorne would hear, "What are you using that guy for?" I remember one time they did a Q rating and I happened to be on the show that they evaluated. They got all this stuff on who's likable on the show and who's not. It was like the second or third thing I ever did, and I guess whoever did the Q thing, they said I sucked and I was not fun to watch. And so I remember Lorne caught some flack from NBC saying, "Don't use that guy, people don't like him." But Lorne and Downey and Smigel, they kind of looked past that. Lorne always said, "When you first get on the show, it's going to take time for the audience to like you, because they're used to seeing Dana and Nealon and Hartman and guys that they're comfortable laughing with." Sure enough, they cut to one of us young buffoons and they go, "Who's that guy? How did this idiot get a chance?" But after a few times of being on the show, the audience grew a little more comfortable with you and they said, "Okay, this guy, I guess, is on Saturday Night Live." And then you get more confidence as a performer. Jack Handy. I was in a fraternity in college, and I thought I had heard some pretty graphic sex stories, but Sandler would just go into detail about some of his sexual adventures to the point where you would just be crying and laughing. It was so embarrassing, just the details he would go into. But very funny. Sandler was always a sweet guy to me, and I think to most people on the staff. Adam Sandler. I remember, actually, my first skit. I was in a thing that Smigel wrote and that I helped write a little bit. And it was Tom Hanks and Dana Carvey, and I just came on, I just had two lines, and I remember that countdown. I remember telling Hanks right before, "Whew, I'm nervous." And he goes, "Hey, it's going to be all right." I said, "Man, I feel like I'm going to faint or something." He goes, "Well, don't." I wasn't always funny on the show. I remember sometimes I would be funny at dress rehearsal because I felt loose and like, well, no one's really going to see this, just this couple hundred people. And I was used to doing stand-up in clubs, and I felt pretty confident in front of a crowd of 200 or so. But then the live show would come on, and this happened to me the first couple of years, I'd hear the countdown, and I'd be like, oh no, everyone's going to see this. I'd better do as well as I did in dress. And then I would choke, and my mind would be spinning out, and right after I would get off, I would say, "Is there any way you could run dress for the West Coast?"
Marilyn Suzanne Miller, writer. It was a boutique aspect. Each one was their own boutique. There was the Adam Sandler boutique, which presented writing and acting and music and lyrics by Adam, which was not the way it was when I was at the original show. We were the writers, they were the actors. And indeed, they were a different generation than me. Adam I loved. It was a whole other sensibility than mine, but I loved it. Janine Garofalo, cast member. The only thing you could count on in my day when I was there was if it was a Sandler or Farley sketch, it was on. That was the only thing you could ever bank on.
Adam Sandler. Herlihy and I wrote a movie, Billy Madison, and we said, "This could be pretty funny. Maybe we could do this." And I showed it to Lorne, and he read it and told me, "There's some funny stuff, but that maybe this shouldn't be my first vehicle." And I remember saying, "Oh, okay, all right, I guess I'll just write something else." I didn't have my feelings hurt at all. I just thought, that's okay, that's how he feels, and he picks what skits I do also. If I write a skit and it doesn't get on the show, I don't sit and cry about it. I just say I'll write another one next week. So that's how I felt about Billy Madison. I said, okay, Herlihy, he doesn't like this one, let's write another one. Chris Rock. I got hired because In Living Color was on. SNL hadn't had a black guy in 8 years or something. In Living Color was hot, so they had to hire a black guy. Trust me, there was no black guys for 8 years, man. Let's put it this way. It didn't hurt. I'm trying to help you with the backdrop of the time. No black guy for 8 years, and Eddie Murphy was under Dick Ebersole, so there was never really a black guy, a star anyway. Damon Wayans was on like 6 months or whatever, and then he got fired. I was a featured guy. Adam actually had to write for like a year. He might have got on here and there, but he basically was a writer for a year. We'd give each other jokes sometimes on each other's pieces. Adam actually gave me the best joke I ever had on the show. It was a Nat X sketch. My militant character, Nat X, used to do these top five lists, 'cause the man wouldn't give him 10. So, top five reasons why black guys don't play hockey? Adam gave me the joke. Don't feel the need to dominate another sport. Adam Sandler. Adam Sandler, man. Good guy. Fred Wolf. Rock is so smart. God, he's so smart. And he has such a unique sense of humor. We would talk sometimes, you know. We shared an office when he was there. We had these connecting offices in the back toward what's now Update. But anyway, we would talk forever. He was so smart about things. And he appreciated Jim Downey as much as anyone else did. Chris Rock. I watched it as a kid, sure, loved it, dreamed of being on it. It was my dream. I was 21 when I joined the cast. I got a duplex apartment in Fort Greene. I bought a car, a Corvette, that stuff. My mom started making money doing stand-up, too. That was cool. Prices go up. I had a big year. First SNL, then the movie New Jack City came out, so I was hot shit. At least, I thought I was. The live show was incredible. It was incredible to meet these famous people every week, and see these great musical acts, and see this whole show form around you, and how they built it. The best thing about the show was that when you did write a piece, you were responsible for it. You were in charge of the casting. You were in charge of the costumes. You produced the piece. I wouldn't know what the fuck I was doing if I hadn't been on Saturday Night Live. It's the absolute best training you can have in show business. Dana Carvey was the show. He carried the show on his back. Add to him Mike Myers, Jan Hooks, and the others, and I think it was a great cast. Our cast actually went on to the most success afterwards, probably. Even Rob Schneider is in big movies. History will say we were the best cast ever. Adam Sandler. That's why I love Rock, because he's got the balls to say anything he wants to. I think we had quite a cast, no doubt about it. You can list off our guys, and both on the show and hanging out with them, they are the guys that make me laugh the hardest. When I got there, a lot of guys who were my age, the younger guys on the show, we respected the older guys. We knew that when Dana and Phil and Neelan and Dennis and Jan Hooks went out there, they crushed. They knew what they were doing. And we watched them when we were at home, so that when we got there, we were just psyched about getting to say we worked with these guys. And the fact that a lot of younger guys were writers also, it made sense that we had to pay our dues and write stuff, and try to impress those guys and say, "Hey, we wrote you a good sketch. Do you mind if I play the busboy?" It 100% made sense. Chris Rock. Eddie was the biggest star. Anybody who says different is making a racist argument. Eddie Murphy has the biggest numbers in the history of movies. Grosses are people. It's not dollars marching in. Those are people. Belushi didn't have a movie as big as Trading Places, and that's not even Eddie's biggest movie. Blues Brothers is not as big as 48 Hours. It's not. Animal House had a cultural impact, but Belushi's not the star of Animal House. He's the breakout guy. It was still an ensemble. He was the best of the ensemble. Eddie Murphy's a star, man. He's probably the only guy of the SNL posse to embrace stardom. It's Elvis. He won't talk to anybody about the show. He's done with it. He's not bitter about it. He loves it. He totally credits the show. I don't want to speak for him, but I think he does get pissed when they make fun of him, only because the show would have gotten canceled if he hadn't been there. There would be no show, so he deserves a pass on that aspect. The show would have absolutely gotten canceled. There were really no stars. Have you watched the reruns on Comedy Central? When they do the intros and Don Pardo is saying the names, the yell on Eddie Murphy is so much greater than for anybody else in the cast. Lorne Michaels. As the 15th anniversary approached, I met with Eddie Murphy. He couldn't have been nicer, was very gracious. But there was a thing that Billy Crystal had said about him in a Playboy interview that Eddie didn't like. So what I was told was that Eddie would come on the anniversary show, but he wouldn't want Billy Crystal to be on, and I had already invited Billy Crystal. I think Eddie felt Billy was wrong for telling tales out of school. Tim Meadows. I think Chris Rock and I had a good time just being friends and experiencing and stuff, but I don't think creatively he had a good time. I think it was hard for him to express his comic thoughts and stuff, and the kinds of things he wanted to do. A lot of his stuff didn't get on, and it's the same as it is now. Chris and I would have maybe one sketch a week or every other week or whatever. I mean, we never had shows like Dana or Mike. I've never been in more than 4 sketches a show in the 9 years I was there. I've never had a show like Will Ferrell or Jimmy Fallon, for that matter. Even when Jimmy was a featured player, he had more sketches than I would. Chris Rock. I was on the bench. 3 years, 60 shows. I was probably on 55, 52 of them. I had a talk with whoever the new black guys are now. Tracy Morgan and the other guy. I forget his name. They don't really have stars now, so I told these guys they've got to assert themselves. When I got there were stars, real stars. Dana Carvey was a star of the show. Dennis Miller was a star. Mike Myers and Wayne's World was really popular. Phil Hartman was big on the show. There were a lot of big people on the show. So for me to not get on wasn't that big a deal. Black people, I guess, stopped looking for me after the 2nd year. You know what happened? It was like when Eddie was on, there was nothing else for black people to watch. So his first year, he didn't get on until the end of the show. I was one of those black people who'd wait until the end of the show to see my favorite guy. By the time I got on, there were all these other things on TV with black people in them, so you don't wait until the end of SNL to see a black guy. You watch another show. Eddie Murphy was for everybody, but we got him first. We knew. My frustration was half that, and the other half, like the black comedy boom was happening, and I wasn't part of it. In Living Color was a big show, and Def Comedy Jam was on HBO, and Martin Lawrence was on. So there was all this stuff happening, and I was over here in this weird world, this weird waspy world. But the things I learned there, there'd be no Chris Rock show. I never would have had the success that I had with that, if I hadn't been on SNL learning how to run a show. I didn't go to college, so it was all school to me. Everyone was a professor. Professor Al Franken, Professor Phil Hartman. Norm MacDonald, cast member. I always hear about how Chris Rock was underutilized and stuff. That's not really true. I mean, they let you do whatever you want on that show, so you can't blame anybody. It's just that Chris is a great stand-up comedian, a great voice. Unfortunately, that doesn't mean he's a great sketch comedy comedian. Chris Rock. Can't compete with white people, man. You'll lose your mind. My mother told me that a long time ago. Just find your spot. Find your spot. Work within that spot. Okay, everybody's writing sketches for the host. They've got to do something without the host. Let me write something without the host. I was a separate thing. With Tim Meadows being on the show, you know somewhere in your mind that if there's two non-white pretty good sketches, they probably won't both get on, and they'll never go back to back, even if they have nothing to do with each other. One could be about medieval times, and one could be a drag racing thing, but you're never going to see this sketch with a bunch of black people and this other sketch with a bunch of black people back to back. One might go near the top of the show, and the other would be at the end of the show. That's how it was in comedy clubs, too. One black comic goes on at 9 o'clock. They will not be putting me on at 9:15. Same goes with women. It was just men in power overreacting, overthinking things. Fred Wolf. The one thing I will say is that while Chris was on the show, I would walk somewhere with him and everyone was recognizing him. Everyone out there knew who he was, and typically he'd have more of a black slant to some of the stuff he was doing. And I think he felt like his audience wasn't really watching Saturday Night Live, and that may be the case. But I also think he's been able to cross over quite a bit, and I think some of the stuff he learned at Saturday Night Live, or was able to sort of do at Saturday Night Live, probably helped him prepare for that. If he had started at In Living Color, maybe he would have jump-started much faster than he did at Saturday Night Live. My observation was, yeah, he was having a rough time. But I don't think Saturday Night Live hurt him in any way. Chris Rock. Maybe I could have worked harder. As I think back on it, I worked just as hard as anybody else. But as my father raised me, you've got to work harder than the white man. You can't work as hard. You're not going to get anywhere. I don't want to say anything bad about the place. They're good people. It's not the place for a black guy. It's not the hippest place, man. We used to always get the black acts the year they were finished, like the music acts. So we got Hammer when he did Too Legit to Quit, when he did the Addams Family theme song on his way out. We get Whitney Houston on the way out. I'm just telling the truth, man. Who wrote for me? Me, man. Just me. No black writers, and no one really got into that side of the culture. Half the culture's into some form of hip-hop sensibility, half of the white culture. It's not just a black thing. But the show's never really dealt with that part of the culture. Even now. David Mandel. I was a fan of Rock's from before I got there, and I had his original stand-up album. He's a genius, obviously. And his stand-up acts are as close as it gets to perfection. At the time, I just don't think what he was doing was just exactly right. I mean, even now, when you see the success he's having in the movies and stuff, he's basically still playing variations on Chris Rock. At the time, on the show, people were trying to write characters for him and things like that. And I just don't think that's what he does. And so it was sort of a bad match at the time. I don't think anybody was saying, that was genius and it wasn't getting on. I just think it wasn't a good match. Chris seemed incredibly frustrated. So were a lot of people. Chris Rock. It was the best time of my life. The show, that's one thing. But then there's The Hang. The Hang was the best time of my life. I honestly tell you, I made friendships that will last for the rest of my life. Most people had to share. They had a partner in their office. I had a four-person office. Me, Sandler, Farley, and Spade. We shared an office, and those are my boys for life. For life. I love those guys. Adam Sandler. Backstage with Chris Rock, Farley, Spade was the best. Nothing was better than having a read-through. You stayed up all Tuesday night, all of us did that, and then we'd do the read-through and you wouldn't know what was getting on the show, but you'd have an hour or so while those guys were figuring it out. So we'd all go to China Regency up on 55th, and we'd eat and watch Farley eat more than us. Farley was so happy. I think we went there the most because they had a Lazy Susan. It's easier that way. That's all we did. We just talked about comedy. What we just heard in the read-through, what was funny, what we didn't like, what we thought was going to get on, what was going to get past dress, that kind of stuff. We lived for comedy. We still do. Every one of us, sadly, I think, the women and the other people in our lives have to deal with the fact that we think of our comedy first. I'm not saying that when something important comes up we can't drop it, but it's on our minds more than you would think. We wake up thinking about jokes. We go to lunch together and that's all we talk about. I think we've become pretty obsessive with it. Obsessed or obsessive, I don't fucking know.
Janine Garofalo. I was on from September 94 to March of 95, less than a year. I'd been a longtime fan of SNL. I mean, it certainly has had its highs and lows. Lows being the Gene Dumanian era, and then another low being the brief time that I was on it. Those are the two lowest of the lows. The season that I was on it, the system was geared toward failure. The prevailing comedy tastes were certainly none that I could support or get behind. I did not think we were doing a quality show. And if you mentioned that, you found you were an extremely unwelcome guest. You are a very unwelcome family member if you do not wholeheartedly accept whatever the level of comedy is at the time.
Chris Elliott, cast member. All the performers there are required to write. That was another thing that bugged me when I got there, was that there was this pressure that if you wanted to get on the air, you had to write some material for yourself. And I had stopped doing that. I was at a point now where people were writing for me, and when I did write, I was getting paid for that. But at SNL, performers are sort of just expected to write. For nothing. It's not a separate sort of deal. I remember mentioning that to Herb Sargent once while he was urinating. And he sort of, you know, blew me off. How does this show get away with having these guys write stuff and not pay them through the Writers Guild? And I guess there's just some loophole about performers writing their own material that gets away from the guild. The only thing I can remember actually enjoying doing on that show was something that was very Letterman-esque, where I just started a skit that was really lame and then, you know, broke in and just told everybody, "That's it for me. I'm leaving SNL. Goodbye." And walked out of the studio. And as soon as I went through the studio doors, it turned black and white, and it was kind of obvious. It looked a lot like, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald being brought down the hallway at the Dallas precinct, and then I get shot at the end. Anything else that I did on that show, I didn't do very well.
Janine Garofalo. I had desperately wanted to live in New York City and do a live comedy show from that building, 30 Rock. I just thought it would be the greatest job in the world, and I had friends who had done it and friends who were on it, even though, oddly enough, I had been warned by everyone who had been on it not to do it. I had friends who were writers who had left, and a couple of cast members who had left who I was friendly with who said, "You're not going to like it." They just felt it would not be a place where I would thrive, especially coming off of Larry Sanders and Ben Stiller's show, which were very progressive, intelligent, and collaborative television programs.
Chris Elliott. I think people just thought I would go there and do my own thing and, you know, be great on the show. And I was thinking the total opposite, that I would go there and everybody else would write for me and I'd have an easy walk through the show. And neither happened.
Janine Garofalo. I can still remember one sketch in particular, where aliens had taken some of the male cast members on the ship and had anally probed them and written "bitch" in lipstick on their chests. Is that funny? It was a Malox moment every 5 minutes. I had irritable bowel syndrome every day. My drinking just got out of hand. I would credit SNL with being very instrumental to some bad habits that certainly increased. I wanted to quit after the first week. I phoned my agent and said, "This is not a good fit. There's something wrong here." There is a tangible, almost palpable, perhaps the word is visceral, feeling of bad karma when you walk into the writer's room. There is something rotten in Denmark.
Chris Elliott. There were so many people in the cast. There was no reason for there to be so many people. There were times when I'd get in my munchkin makeup and sit until, you know, 5 to 1 and come out and do one sketch. There was no reason. When the show first started and there was a smaller cast, it was funny to see, like, Belushi doing Marlon Brando and then having to run and change and be in some other sketch back to back. And that never happened with us.
Janine Garofalo. Every Wednesday there was always a great show in there. There were always funny sketches on Wednesday. Just somehow, I don't know why, writers were doing some really great funny stuff that was not getting on the air. I don't know. For whatever reason, that season seemed to be the year of fag bashing and using the words bitch and whore in a sketch. Just my luck. I was always surprised that a chapter of ACT UP never showed up to protest. Honestly. If you stepped out of line press-wise, you would hear about it. And if they didn't appreciate what you said in the press, there would be Xerox copies of it for other people to read. It was the tactics of intimidation. There was so much pressure not to complain. If anybody got anti-fan mail or a disparaging note, it would be posted. I didn't understand that. It was another tactic of breaking you. Lorne enjoys the house divided syndrome. I think he prefers the house divided. I learned that I made the experience even worse than it should have been. I was defeated. I was weak. I drank too much. I will go with the Eleanor Roosevelt quote, "No one can make you feel inferior without your consent." I gave my consent freely. And every time I waited for Lorne for 5 hours, luckily I didn't do it more than once or twice, but once I did it the first time, I gave my consent to feel inferior. I gave my consent to Marcy Klein to feel inferior because I was intimidated by her. I gave my consent to the other writers and my co-workers that I was just weak, you know? I was a loser. And so I definitely learned from that experience. Other than that, I don't know what I took away from it. But I guess that's pretty significant.
Fred Wolfe. Janine Garofalo was awful on the show. She had it completely and totally wrong. She's a very, very insecure person. She was my friend. I helped her get on the show, and she's a very insecure person, and she's unwilling to sort of stand on her own body of work and ride on that talent. Instead, what she does is sort of tears everything down around her, A, to make her feel better about what she's doing, and B, so she doesn't have to really actually attempt anything upon which she could fail. And so she was an infection in that show, in that she was going to the press. At that point she was a darling of the press because she was sort of an articulate female, and going on about how it's a men's club at Saturday Night Lifeless. And that's just bullshit. It's an absolute total bullshit label. It just so happens that men are wildly more successful than women at Saturday Night Live, but not by design. It's just genetic makeup, in my opinion. Janine Garofalo never spent an all-nighter. The writers and performers that went on to do very well never missed an all-nighter session. Janine Garofalo never got with the writers and wrote sketches that she was dying to perform and would do anything that she could to get on the air. What she did instead was glom onto the host and just tear the show apart for the whole week, about how it's a boys' club there and how they don't let creativity flourish, and if they see certain initials on sketches, they won't laugh at them at read-through. All these negative things that were just patently ridiculous. And then she was a spectacular failure on the show. Chris Elliott. Janine and I hung out a lot that year because, in a way, she was in the same boat as I. But she was a lot more capable in that arena than I was. And I guess she had the whole female issue to deal with there, which was a big issue, especially with guys like Sandler and stuff, who were at their peak. So a lot of the humor was not up her alley. Paul Simon, host. Janine Garofalo has no case. She wanted to be on the show. She came on. It was during one of the show's low points. She signed on for, you know, whatever, for the year, and she had a miserable time. And she asked to be released, and Lorne released her. You know, she messed him up. In the middle of his season, he had to go replace her. She could have had some aesthetic disagreement with the show, which she did. I mean, no doubt about it. I mean, she vocalized it. She actually said it in public. He didn't say in public anything about her. What harm did SNL do to Janine Garofalo? Any harm that she was on Saturday Night Live for, you know, 5 months? Did anybody ever say, "Except for stuff you did on Saturday Night Live, what a great career you've had"? And nobody there bad-mouthed her either.